This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week, we are going to return back to the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California, where we were attending the Magic Collectors Expo. And we had some very interesting guests. Last week, we spoke with Mark Jensen. This week, we're going to speak with Julie Ng, who is someone that many of you do know. Last week, I mentioned that not many of you probably knew who Mark Jensen was, but I wanted him to be a representative of kind of the everyman, if you will, who is a magic collector. But Julie, in this case, actually is the executive director for Magicana up in Toronto, Canada, and also is the editor of the Magic Call, which is Magic Collectors magazine, which is the house organ, I believe, for the Magicana organization. And she also, perhaps you may recognize the name and certainly the face and the voice from her being one of the co-sponsors or co-hosts, I should say, along with Jonathan Levitt upon occasion at Magic Live, if you attend that convention. And I know many of you do. Typically, when we do these conversations, they're not intended to be interviews, but this week there was a lot of background material that Julie was glad to share with us, and I thought it was quite fascinating that gives you more background and texture as to why she became who she is today. And I think it's, again, a fascinating history she has, beginning with her father, Tony Ng, and how that he had influenced her to follow the career that she has. So I'm sure there are several things in this week's episode that will interest you regardless of your background, and I think you'll find it entirely worth your while to hear about Julie's background and how she got started in magic and why she does what she does. Well, enough from me. Let's hear more from her. So please welcome my guest this week, Ms. Julie Ng, here on The Magic Word. I want to talk today with somebody who is a collector, performer, very interesting person, a presenter, and someone, if you've ever attended Magic Live the last few years, you've probably seen her as one of the presenters along with Jonathan Levitt. And she is also the editor of Magic Call. She's an executive director of the my mind just went blank there for a second.
Arts organization called Magicana.
Magicana. That's what I'm trying to say. Thank you very much. Up in Toronto, Canada. And she's here with me now, and we happen to be in Long Beach, California. Here she is, Julie Ng. Hey there, Julie. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for inviting me to be a part of this.
Well,
this
I'm so fun. Glad and proud to finally have you, because I know a lot of times at magic conventions, people get torn in so many different directions. We're here now at the Magic Collectors Expo here in Long Beach, and this is one of the times which you are not presenting. And I don't think that Magicana has a booth here this year, do you?
I get to kind of just come and
play. That's what I thought, just kind of hang out. Because, I mean, like at Magic Live, you're going to be so busy, and you and David Venn have a booth there too. Is that right?
Well, we've in the last few years, you know, we've really changed our activity, but in the past, we certainly have had one. That's where we launched the first Johnny Thompson book. You know, the pre-sales were launched at Magic Live.
Well, that's right.
That was very exciting. And, you know, the work at Magic Live is just so crazy. It was just so many wonderful opportunities to catch up with people. You know, I grew up on the West Coast, but I live in Toronto, so it's an opportunity for me to see a lot of my West Coast friends and to, as I say, catch up. And a larger convention like that also, as you know, pulls us in so many different directions. So I don't mind just attending for change.
And just kind of being on the periphery and kind of attending
absorbing
the events. And absorbing it, exactly right. And having some time to actually have some quality conversations with people rather than say, hey, how you doing? Hey, how's you? Hey, how are you?
Exactly.
Right. Going back to the fact that you did grow up over in the West Coast. Now, Tony Ng was your father, and he had a magic shop. And where was that located, by the way?
My dad, that was in Victoria, British Columbia.
Okay.
So my father was born in British Columbia, in Victoria, as I was. And Victoria is on an island, Vancouver Island. So it's quite close to, you know, it's an hour and a half ferry ride to go to Vancouver. But we can also take a seaplane to Seattle, or you can do the hydrofoil to Seattle. You can take a ferry to Port Angeles. I mean, Victoria also had this great history of doing the Tri-City Magic Conventions between Victoria, Seattle, and Tacoma.
Which is different than the PCAM.
And then there's, of course, the PCAM. PCAM. This year, Victoria is hosting the PCAM.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
When's that going to be, by the way?
I think it's in November this year.
Okay. Well, this will go out before then. So I encourage people to go and see that as well. Are you going to be involved with the PCAM in any way this year?
Or? I haven't been officially connected to it yet, but you know, you never know. There, like you said, there's some time.
There's some time, yeah, between now and then. And so the shop that he ran, he had that for a number of years. Did you, I know you worked behind the counter.
I did. Well, my dad had a very strong history in magic in Victoria. He loved it as a kid. Now, while he was born in Victoria, my grandparents had a restaurant in Sydney, BC. So it's about 30 kilometers away from Victoria.
Okay.
And in my grandparents' day, it was not an easy drive. Now it's a breeze, but
we say not an easy drive because the road conditions weren't good, like two-lane roads or something?
Very far away. Okay. It felt like you're going to a new city. A different city. So it was quite a trek. There was quite a distance. Okay. But in that time, my grandparents had this restaurant, a cafe. My grandfather was a cook and a chef, and my grandmother was really hardworking. Just hospitality management was her thing. So my dad grew up in the restaurant business and in hospitality, along with his siblings. And having that, I think, engagement really at an early age with customers and experiencing that way.
Right.
The barber had shown him a coin trick. You know, must have been something, a very simple one. But boy, was he hooked because he saw what it could do to engage people. Mm-hmm. And then he started performing a little bit at tableside and whatnot. And it was always infectious. And in fact, someone reached out to me recently saying that even as a kid around 9 or 10 years old, this person who had reached out to me said, you know, my friend was in the hospital and your dad came to, he was, I'm sorry, excuse me, I mistold the story. The person who reached out to me was in the hospital.
Right.
And I don't know, something like an accident or something. So he's a kid himself. And so my father came to visit with this boy and he was performing card tricks for him and just came to keep him company and he entertained him. And I never knew that story. So he'd been obviously doing this for a while.
For a long time.
And had a connection to people.
And he did it for a reason then also. He was kind of helping people, encouraging people. He could see the joy he was giving other people.
I think that's exactly it. He really loved people. And he also collected an eclectic group of friends. So when my dad started doing, you know, just close up and just seeing the power of that, he, you know, I forget how young he was when he met my mother. They were teenagers when they got married. I think my dad was maybe 20. My mom was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had me early and then they had my sister very soon after. So it's a family.
Just the two of you?
Yep. Family of four. But my dad then had a young family to take care of. My mother was taking care of two little babies. So at that time, they got married in 68. And my dad had just sort of become this professional magician. And he's just started to meet mentors. You know, we just heard this great panel of speakers.
Yeah. By the way, people who are listening to that, we just heard the Long Beach Mystics talk about their history and everything.
That just drove me back to, it's wonderful history that's unique to Long Beach and the Long Beach Mystics are famous for it. Mm-hmm. But it reminded me of how strong a community of magicians in that age group can be. My father had just found mentors a little bit older than him, not quite the same as this Long Beach Mystic teen group, like a peer group. But he still had mentors and he still had mentors' support. And they encouraged him to, you know, go out. If you're going to do this, be serious about it. Try and create something that's, you know, to be pragmatic. You can't just do one kind of magic. You have to be able to, Victoria is a small town. You have to be able to work in different venues. So he learned very early how to hustle, you know, and how to work. So he turns sort of into this pro. And he's performing through the city. And at that time, as I said, he's got a young family to support too. He had also worked in a wholesaling business. He was a partner in a wholesaling business. And the wholesaling business was to provide wares for the tourism shops in Victoria.
Oh.
So he used to just know, he just knew that downtown core very, very well where all the tourists hung out. And that Victoria is and was a very popular destination. It's an island, so the cruise ships would come in. It depends a lot on tourism. A lot of Americans would come up through the harbor. It's just a natural gateway.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's a gateway for many historic reasons too, a port city. So he ends up becoming a bartender.
I didn't think that was where you're going with the story. Okay.
He ends up being a bartender. A friend got him into bartending. And he's a young guy, and he starts off at an Army Navy bar. You know, okay. it's a little rough and tumble.
Yeah. But, it's like a biker bar kind of.
Yeah, yeah. But it was
one step up.
It happened to be at the foot of the harbor, you know, just as you entered the harbor, right at the bottom, you climb up this hill and there's this, it was a beautiful location. And that's where the club was. So okay. I remember you had to go up the stairs and I was a really young kid. I think I was maybe, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years old, maybe even 5. But the way this situation was, you know, my mom had to go, she was working. She had to go pick up my sister at another daycare because she was that much younger. But then my father would pick me up from school, mm-hmm. bring me down to the Army Navy club to wait for my mom.
Okay.
Right. Because then she could come by and pick me up. So I was hanging out in the bar office of an Army Navy club as a kid.
Okay. Real appropriate.
Really appropriate. So what are you going to do? It's childcare. And I guess I absorbed a lot of that, obviously by osmosis and just listening. I was.
Now, your dad wasn't doing like bar magic, was he?
He was doing bar magic. Okay. That's how it really evolved for him because he had tough customers, but you have a strong group of regulars.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just see how the hospitality upbringing in him mm-hmm. transferred to the bar and his entrepreneurial spirit. My father didn't drink. And in the end, he ended up being the bar manager of this place. Not quite, but he had an opportunity to really then move to another bar to do bar management there. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he's starting work at the Japanese Village. He would perform. Mickey Hades booked him.
Oh.
Mickey had this group of restaurants and they were called the Japanese Village and they were throughout Canada. And Mickey had swung a contract where he would provide magicians every Sunday. And my father was the one doing Victoria. It was a brand.
And they were doing table to table kind of thing.
Table to table. That teppanyaki. So it's that hot grill that mm-hmm. the chefs would cook in front of and people sat around the grill.
Like a Benihana thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And my father would come in and perform afterward. And he did that. My dad did that for 20 years every Sunday.
20 years. Wow.
And then he would work at the bar. So he mm-hmm. was working at, he changed from
two
the
jobs.
Army Navy. Yeah. And then go to the Red Lion Inn. So he's really honing his skills in magic. And, you know, I'm a kid, so I'm growing up with my dad learning all
this. You're seeing
this
hard
magic.
Work ethic that he's.
And constantly learning.
And hospitality and how friendly he is to others.
But in how the magic made a difference. You know, and how he performed, how he practiced, what he chose. Don't forget, at the same time, we have this magic club, the Victoria Magic Circles, Ring 183.
Right.
An active club. It's a small town, so you have a small group of really active members. And so there's constantly lectures that are coming through. You know, in Vancouver is a partner when you're bringing lectures in, or Seattle, Tacoma, same thing. You know, we just, Calgary, everybody's just sort of, it's a remote area in some way, so you have to make it worth the lecturer's while to come through. So it was a really active community in magic as well. So that's really where I kind of grew up. I joined very early. I was always a part of the shows. You know, my dad had my sister and I coming out of boxes practically before we could walk. You know,
Where did he perform those kinds of stage shows then?
In Victoria.
No, but I understand. But were they like the Army Navy Club? Did he have a stage or something? I mean, understand bar magic and understand restaurant magic.
Yes.
But then he started doing some stage stuff.
So just, it's an interesting question because again, Victoria is a small town.
So how would you find the venues?
So you find the venues. Like people are doing fundraisers. So there's a beautiful couple of theaters in Victoria.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
well,
so they would do fundraisers. Or there's, Tony, you got to come and do the telethon. You know, Tony, you've got to do this fundraiser. Tony, you know, and so he just keep adding on to his show.
Sure.
You know, we just heard this lecture where these guys are talking about constantly. Mm-hmm. So you got to come up with something new all the time. So it was constantly changing the show, adding to the show, trying to find new ways of presenting the show, you know, the same challenge we all face. So I found that now that I look back at it all, you know, my upbringing in this was, again, through this tacit way of learning through my dad, hanging out with him, mm-hmm. being involved very early and watching how my mom and my dad worked. You know, they weren't schooled in theater. But, you know, you learn very quickly by the seat of the fire how to get stuff done, how to book stuff, how to fix stuff, how to build stuff, and how to run a show. Mm-hmm. So they invested in illusions and beautiful, lavish productions. And one of his early mentors really got him into establishing himself as somebody different. And what I mean by that is, you know, really embracing his Chinese heritage.
Oh, okay.
My dad and my sister and I are born here in Canada, as was our grandmother. So we're really a long history as Canadians, but we embraced the Chinese culture, because that's exactly who and where we came from.
Your ancestry, sure.
Yeah. And it was Victoria had a very strong
Chinese community.
Mm-hmm. So that was just natural for us to be a part of that. For example, the Chinese Chinatown Lions Club. You know, those are like the founding charter members. Some of them are like pseudo grandparents to my family, you know, like.
So he would have had an in with them, obviously, to entertain those kinds of groups.
Service clubs.
Because there were probably not a lot of magicians, Chinese magicians.
Okay. No, there are not. Well, they weren't at the time. And again, just by differentiating yourself. So he had these beautiful costumes and, you know.
They were Oriental garb, I guess. Okay.
Very traditional.
I understand. Yeah. Right.
Lavish. You know, there's a whole other story there. Other story there. The Chinese guy not being Chinese enough for the Chinese people, you know.
That is funny. Not Chinese enough.
It's okay. A crazy situation, yeah.
It's like Barack Obama, it wasn't black enough, you know.
Kind of. You know, in this day and age of really addressing appropriate use of, you know, costuming
culture.
And culture, mm-hmm. and is that appropriation? So it was a really interesting time. You know, this is the 70s, you know, and my father was an entrepreneur. He had to hustle again, you know. That's what I learned. In magic, he really had to work many different jobs a lot, you know, and to be diverse and to be able to recognize your market. How do you handle that contract? Business relations.
Right.
So
marketing.
As a kid,
yeah.
And all this time while he's doing all this magic, I've told you he's a bartender.
Yeah.
There was a show he was doing. And he was doing a duck pan, and he didn't bring the
lighter fluid. Yeah.
And, you know, we got to do the show.
Use vodka or something, or tequila?
No, he just lit it, the paper on fire.
Oh, okay.
And this whoosh of smoke came at my dad.
Oh,
it was terrible. So.
Singe his eyebrows?
Worse.
Oh, no.
Worse. He got a good inhalation of smoke.
Not good.
It collapsed the lung. So
oh my God.
That ended all bar days, because those are the days when they still smoked.
Mm.
So it was a very troubling time because, again, it's in the 80s. Now we're probably in the 80s. And, you know, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So he pivots. Instead of working at the bar, the doctor says he can't be around secondhand smoke.
Smoke,
he
right.
recovered, but... It, you know, he was always very sensitive to things like that after mm-hmm, work, mm-hmm. especially smoke. So he pivots by opening a bartending school, and he leverages all the stuff we learn in magic, mm-hmm. audience management, performance, lecturing, presenting. You know, he puts all of that into a bartending school. It becomes a very successful school. He's still performing around the city. So people want to be a part of this crazy character's trajectory of like, and then my dad gets the school accredited with the province. So it's a real trade school.
Hmm.
So it had a really good potential avenue for my parents to move into a real career and then soon retirement.
Right.
But then, just then, when things are going very rosy, the magic shop comes up for sale.
Who owned that before? That wasn't Mickey Hades' place, no.
It wasn't Mickey Hades' place. Mickey was in, he had a shop, a satellite shop in Vancouver.
Okay.
In Seattle. And but we had the Crazy Frank had the shop in Victoria, from what I remember.
Mm-hmm.
But then he had sold that shop, and another woman had bought it, and she moved the location. But then that wasn't working out for her and her family, so that's when my dad bought it. And then he moved it very close to that Army-Navy bar I was talking about on the harbor, so in a tourist destination stop.
Oh,
and
big difference.
Big difference.
Yes.
And my father turned Tony's Trick and Joke Shop into a Victoria destination to visit.
Yeah.
So this became and now I'm that much older. I'm now in high school.
And he's thinking, I should have done this a long time ago.
And retail's tough. Retail's tough. Especially
he's used to hard work, it sounds like, though, too.
Yeah. But it's seasonal, you know.
No, that's true.
The Halloween was very, very busy. We put all the magic away because it was so busy.
Most magic shops did that very thing. They closed the magic shop or the part of their business and focused just on that. And wouldn't even show you tricks or didn't have demos. It's like it took too much time away from selling or renting costumes.
And it was packed.
Yeah.
It was packed. You know, Herb Morrissey gave my dad some great advice on how to sort of, you know, transition that for that period.
That's right, because Morrissey was a Canadian company.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. Herb Morrissey was famous of course, in Toronto, but they were in Montreal originally.
Hmm.
And I think that, you know, meeting Herb, and Herb is a character, but he decided to take a liking in my dad and really we became good friends. And he really supported. And, you know, Tony, you know, if you really want to make this work, you know, and he really helped my parents set up the again, sharing inside trade secrets on how to turn these things around. This retail's very tough. And today, I don't know how any of these magic shops survive. It's so
I don't know how
brick
and mortar magic shops do make it, because going back to the costumes for an example for just a moment, how that business has completely dried up because they have these little pop-up places around Halloween that takes the business that are not nearly as good of a costume. Anyhow, don't get me started on that, but that has taken away business, unfortunately. And that was kind of where they made bread and butter a lot of, you know, for the year was Halloween. They can cover their annual nut during October.
Exactly.
So now it's tougher.
Now it's
with online shops, obviously, with magic, I don't see how brick and mortar places are making it.
And that was a really interesting thing. You know, the shop came into popularity through the destination.
Mm-hmm.
It's an attraction.
Right.
I remember we're very close to the U.S. So a lot of these grad trips, you know, grade 7, grade 8 grad trips, the students would come up to Victoria. It would be a destination and a treat for the kids for graduating into middle school or high school.
Mm-hmm.
And on their schedule, it became a thing. Visit Tony's Trick and Joke Shop.
Oh,
you know, they're
cool.
Going to the BC Museum. They're going to Butchart Gardens. But you got to go see Tony's Trick and Joke Shop.
That's
that was
great.
Part of their agenda. So he became, you know, he carved that all out at a time when we were still, the internet, of course, was, you know, on the rise. But we're dialing in. We're using modems. It wasn't anything high speed.
Of course.
So we did have, you know, thanks to Morrissey, we tried to build up a mail order business as well. And I helped my parents, you know, bring it into a computer age by trying to create the website. I helped them buy a domain and, you know, get all that stuff.
Sure.
When it was very early.
Yeah.
And it was great for a while, but it's nothing to where it was today. And all the while, you know, my dad had.
It was time-consuming and expensive. For those who don't know or understand back then about trying to buy a domain, I mean, now you can buy them for literally nothing. Those were thousands and thousands of dollars.
Oh,
and plus the time, and you had to know programming and everything. It was not an easy thing.
There were no rules. It was the Wild West.
Wild West, yeah.
Everything was very, very, you know, fly by the seat of your pants.
Yeah.
You know, you just did not know what
was going
on.
That was a full-time job probably for you, putting all that together.
I was interested in it. You know, I would think I was probably just getting into university and—
Studying what?
I was in commerce.
Okay.
So— which was a natural segue for me. You know, I started off in, you know, all the fancy academics. I tried economics. I thought, oh, that would be a good, you know, strategy. I'll work for the government. Like, none of that ever worked out.
Mm-hmm.
I had an entrepreneurial background, entrepreneurial spirit.
Just like your parents.
And all the while, you know, I should say, while I'm speaking so much about my father, you know, this is where he got me started.
Mm-hmm.
While I was helping him as a kid, I think I was 11 years old when I did my first show. I was barely taller than the kids I was performing for.
Mm-hmm.
He would drive me to the show. He would set it up for me. He made me pay. I had to pay him $5 to help me do all of that from my take, because I wanted to teach me. You know, if you can have this really great opportunity to make some money, to carve out a career for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It did not bother him that I was little or a female in magic. He thought that these are great advantages. You can differentiate yourself. So he's passing along all the lessons he learned to me and to forwarding me and to encouraging me. Now, my sister didn't take to magic the same way I did, but she was a very good supporter to me. She became my assistant.
Mm-hmm.
I would drive, she would set up. I mean, it was a really great family business. And as I was getting into university, I was performing, but I was also using all the magic experience I had. You know, I've been doing that for a long time by the time you get to university. You know, all of the skills I had learned from presenting magic, assisting in magic, so listening to the audience, reading, listening to my dad with code language, you know, sometimes something's going wrong. I can hear it because I know I can. What is he saying? Like, I can read what he's saying to me while he's entertaining people through his script. And it was, you know, I learned all these things without realizing I had learned so much.
You were. It's just subliminally, subconsciously, I should say,
Yeah. And that really helped me when I had this opportunity. But there's this point where I keep saying, you know, we grew up together in this family business. We're very close-knit, et cetera, et cetera. He had a very flourishing business. He sold the bartending school, buys the magic shop. It's all going very well. But, you know, all the time, my sister and I are growing up.
Yeah.
You know, we're forging our own careers. Mm-hmm. My sister is an architect and she went to Vancouver and then
And your mom was doing what during that time?
She's basically supporting my dad. She's the backbone. She was the one keeping everything running.
All the records.
My dad's
and
demonstrating.
Finances.
But mom's running the shop.
Okay. You know?
Yeah, she's ordering. She's selling. She's buying. She's fulfilling all the orders, keeping track of the staff. I mean, that's mm-hmm. my dad was the guy at the counter.
The front office.
Yeah. So when they had this shop, I think I was still at the 530, they're at the 532 location and they were going to move locations. And these lots of transition then was happening. My sister had moved away. She was going to school in Vancouver by then. Mm-hmm. And then I had an opportunity to move to Toronto. There was a contract for just a couple of weeks, you know, maybe it might extend to 3 months. So I took that contract and it's been like 28 years, you know, I just have never got back. It just one thing led to another.
Sure,
you
sure,
know?
Yeah.
So it's, and that was because of my dad. I would not have the career and work and the opportunities and experiences I've had mm-hmm. had not been for my father seeing that Victoria, as beautiful and wonderful as it was with this great business that I could take over, mm-hmm. he saw the limitations for me. And when I came to him, I said, you know, this guy, David Benn, he says he's got this show. There's an opportunity for me to join, but I got to go now, like literally in 2 weeks. I have mm-hmm. to turn around and go
was
back.
Was that when he was doing The Conjurer?
He was remounting The Conjurer. Mm-hmm. It's the first time they had brought it together. They had two parts. I was going to bring it together to form this very... They were remounting the whole show to make it a 1 hour, 30-minute show
okay.
in Toronto. And it was a big deal because they're, you know, refurbishing this theater. And it was a period piece, too. So it was very different. Mm-hmm. And I had never worked in anything like that before. And
so when you say he was remounting this was something in which he had done before, but he's...
They did them in parts before.
I see.
So that was for the Shaw Festival. So they had 3 years of different versions of the show. Mm-hmm. And 2 years they had done the part, the you know, the Conjurer and the complete Conjurer. So then they were going to bridge the two pieces.
I see.
And make this.
Okay, that makes sense.
In Toronto, not yes. in Niagara on the Lake.
Okay.
So it was a really big investment for a bunch of reasons. You know, theater in Toronto at the time, you know, this is like I said, 27 years ago. It was a big deal.
And you were going to be the assistant then or something? Or were going to be helping him with the effects?
I didn't even know what my job was.
What your job was. Okay, fine.
I had, my father was friends with David. And
oh, that was how it came about. I didn't know how you met David.
Yeah,
okay.
They were friends.
Yeah.
And I happened to go, I had finished university. I happened to go visit my university girlfriend. She was, you know, we would study together. She got this job. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go and visit her. And Dad said, this is what he always did. Whenever you go to a new city, oh, I should bring up my friend. So he says, you should call my friend David Benn, you know.
Yeah, I know somebody there.
Yeah. So I phoned David and he says, oh, come on up for lunch. And outside, David says, come, just pass by my house first and then we'll walk over to this great restaurant. I said, okay, that's weird, but fine. Mm-hmm. And he lived very central downtown and I popped over and I meet this gentleman coming out of, it appears, David's house. And I said, well, I know that's not David. But he knew who I was. He said, Julie, you must be Julie. I said, mm-hmm. yes. I don't know a soul in Toronto. How do you know who I am?
Yeah.
And he sticks out his hand. He goes, hi, I'm Pat. And it was Patrick Watson. And Patrick Watson is an icon in Canadian television and media. He's the guy who basically created the formation of what 60 Minute is today.
Oh, okay.
This hour has 7 days.
Yep. I'm unfamiliar with who that is.
Yeah.
So he's the Canadian guy.
So Patrick and David were good friends and Patrick was directing the show.
I see.
So when Patrick stuck out and set his hand and said, hi, I'm Pat, that was my audition. I didn't know it.
That's funny. Okay.
They were literally sizing me up.
You obviously passed.
They were sizing me up because they were in the exact moment looking to cast a person to be for their Azra. They had rewritten the script and they wanted
you're a good size for an Azra. You can fit underneath there. You know, you're tall enough, body shape,
so
and everything.
When David heard I was coming to town, he must have called Patrick. They set this up. And
Did your dad kind of know all this was happening?
My father had no idea this was happening.
Okay.
I really was just phoning to have lunch with David as a friend.
I thought maybe he was kind of setting you up.
No.
Okay.
No. So long story short, when Patrick and David found out, you know, my history, you know, David knew my dad and, you know, she's into magic. She's known magic. She performs. So they said, this is such an asset to the show because it's not just an actor. Mm-hmm. It'll be someone who can do this, sure. be an assistant stage manager backstage, and mm-hmm. I can trust this person with the magic right. and blah, 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 blah. So in the end, I turn around and I go back. And as the story goes, you know, David had another assistant. His name was Sully. And Sully came to pick me up from the airport, and Sully became my husband. So,
okay.
So it was a really good deal for me in the end.
Yeah, it worked out well.
So, you know, it's from those funny connections in magic.
You never know.
You never know. And with my relationship then with David, he and Patrick and another very good friend of ours, a documentarian, magician, filmmaker, Daniel Zuckerbrot, the three of them formed Magicana in 2000. Magicana became an official not-for-profit charity in 2006. And I had worked for Magicana on and off.
But all three of them, hold on just a second, going back there, we're all interested apparently in magic history, which is why Magicana came about then.
Magic and magic history and the advancing of magic as an art form. You're
okay.
really seeing magic.
It's completely different than what Bill Kalusha's Conjuring Arts Society is.
Yeah, Bill's Conjuring Arts is also—
more of an archival thing.
Archival. It's a library.
Yeah.
It's a research center.
Physical thing.
Mm-hmm. And it has a kind of a different bent. While we have similar programming, you know, with outreach and community involvement,
yeah.
Magicana focuses slightly different in that it's, you know, pursuing perhaps through publications, online exhibition. It's about sharing the awareness of magic in a way that advances magic, and that includes in educating and sharing with the public what magic is and mm-hmm. can be.
Okay.
The historical side becomes really important. You know, that's one underpinning that was really missing for me in my growing up. You know, my father didn't have a strong grasp of the magic history.
Hmm.
He knew the history of his stuff,
right.
you know, in his group. And so I had recent history. And he had read a lot, but it's not the same as sort of digging down a little deeper, again, with mentorship and guidance.
Yes.
And David, that was really a big part of his era.
Specialty.
Exactly. And now he invites me into working with Magicana. I get to know more about this. I meet more history. You know, you just get involved. And so for me, it's become a great passion and great of great interest, because I see so much importance in having those underpinnings and that foundational block of what is magic, what was magic, where did it come from? I think this is really important to know so that advancing and building has meaning, purpose. I often say this, you know, you really can't know where you're going unless you know where you came from.
Very well said.
Mm-hmm. And I feel this is, for me, these last, you know, 20 plus years have been really important in forging my history, you mm-hmm. know, and me trying to now create new opportunities for magic and for magicians who are younger or don't have those opportunities that I had.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very, very lucky to bridge an interesting generation with an interesting group of people who have only opened doors for me.
And that's because of Magicana?
I think it's because of many things. And I credit my father for just really opening me up into this world, making it normal for me.
Yes.
You know, I never saw it as a weird thing that I was a female in magic. In fact, I kind of got tired of that for a while.
I would think you would, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, this is what I do. This is who I am.
Right.
And someone pointed it out to me, you know, this is my identity.
Sure.
So for me, it was almost an affront to question my position in magic, because you're questioning my validity as me
yes.
in magic.
Yeah.
But now I, of course, see that really different because, you know, when you're outside looking in, it is unusual, and I can appreciate that. But I only appreciated, I think, a layer of it. And I now see my responsibility.
Are you saying from a non-magician looking
totally.
At a magician, or men looking at women?
I think the former rather than the latter.
Okay.
But in many ways, you can say it the same way.
Yeah.
You know, it has that deeper meaning, too.
Yeah.
And I think that as a young person, I didn't understand. I didn't understand why it was so unusual or novel, because I just wanted to—
It seemed natural to you. You grew up that way.
And I wanted to be accepted.
Sure.
And I wanted to fit
everybody
in.
Everybody does, as a human being.
Everybody does. And you have to remember, I'm a kid at that point, too,
yeah.
and a teenager. I'm awkward. I'm looking for my place in the world, too.
Well, I would think also, not just as a woman, but then you have a outside of the Caucasian culture of, that too. So that's another thing. It's a hurdle, I would think, for you.
I had to think about that. Well, I didn't. I'll get back to that. I have a very you know, well-known father in a mm-hmm. small town. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly associated
sure.
being his
oh,
daughter.
Oh, you're Tony's daughter. Yeah.
Exactly. So my identity, you can see where I get a little yeah. pressed up against all of this structure. Mm-hmm. I'm not complaining. It's just, it's a way of being. And mm-hmm. when people start to then question, you know, is it so novel? You're so different. And I'm like, I'm not. I'm me in this. And this is how I grew up. Mm-hmm. Now you add on to that the fact that I'm a female in magic. Mm-hmm. I just learned how to say this fairly recently. I'm a visible minority in magic as well.
Visible minority.
Yeah.
Never heard that term.
So, I mean, Chinese culture as a Chinese magician and a woman in magic, it's a really a novelty. I don't like to say that, but it is when I'm being booked.
Juliana Chan is one of the only other ladies I know that is.
Yeah, but there's
well-known
Jade and the.
Well, true.
Yeah.
I mean, a handful, I should say.
Yeah. And then now there's several other young women mm-hmm. in magic who are of, you know, I've met so many. Mm-hmm. Felice was interviewing me. She's from Boston. We talked a lot about that. Mm-hmm. But my family and my upbringing, my history, we didn't focus on the fact that I was one, like in that group.
Yes.
I grew up
as a magician.
Yeah.
Period.
Period. Mm-hmm. And as a Canadian. Mm-hmm. Period. You know, I didn't even really.
So you really identify a lot with the country of Canada as well. I
yeah.
mean, like we
as
do in
Canadian.
The U.S. as
yeah.
well. So
yeah.
okay, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that that has helped build a different kind of approach for me as well, and mm-hmm. that's also given me a new insight to look at my whole history differently. Because when I was saying earlier. By having that great entree and opportunity to get into magic and to be accepted into magic and to then have that great, you know, David opened up many, many doors for me in just building and helping me bridge my own network and broadening that even further from my father, you know, I have come into contact with amazing individuals mm-hmm. who have only, as I say, supported and opened doors for me. And I'm very grateful for that because it has helped me forward a career in magic. And now I'm kind of in this new role. While I love performing, I love presenting, but I also think
stage close up. What is your preference?
I love close up, but I enjoy the stage too. I just haven't had an opportunity to, you know, really work on new things, you know, since I've sat down and worked with Magic Canada and sort of concentrated on magic history, like Magical or our other publications. Mm-hmm. We used to do a lot of live production, so I would be involved producing.
Shows.
Mm-hmm. And then the children's program, we had a children's program, My Magic Hand, and a seniors program. I would perform for the seniors.
Was that something that was kind of inspired by your father, what he had done then?
Well, it's all, they're all kind of part of, you know, although I'm very familiar with all of those experiences, we kind of formalized that activity at Magicana. You know, mm-hmm. David really challenged me to bring a different kind of structure to what I had learned doing. So things like by forming Magicana and then having these mandates, then getting funding. So the funding, you have to be responsible for fulfilling certain mandates and mm-hmm. reporting those results. You know, I learned how to, you know, I have a commerce degree, but it's the experience of doing all of that. I could put all of my education, both at, you know, academic and magic.
And practical.
Totally practical mm-hmm. and really put it into something that was different.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I've really begun to find my own stride.
Right.
And I think that now is a point where, you know, Magicana has created a nice brand of, you know, elevating the art. I'm very mm-hmm. proud about that. We've established, you know, several books now. I'm working on this very large project that's coming to an end. We got the great opportunity to work with Edwin A. Dawes, Dr. Eddie yeah. Dawes mm-hmm. from
right.
England.
He was a great guy.
He was a terrific guy.
You couldn't keep up with his wealth of knowledge. I mean,
true historian, yeah.
That's understating it, but yes, I don't know what else to say.
And he's a biochemist who invented one of the first early biodegradable plastics. You know,
oh,
like
I didn't know that.
He's
wow.
a super serious yeah. scientist too.
Yeah.
On top of this massive body of work in magic history.
Yeah.
So one of the things he did, one of the gazillion things he did, was he wrote an article for the Magic Circular. That's the mm-hmm. Magic Circle's organ. Mm-hmm. He wrote an article for the Magic Circular every month for 48 years.
Curiosities, magic.
A cabinet of magical curiosities.
I remember going to the centenary for the Magic Circle and getting a DVD of everything to date that he had written. And it was all just on one thing. And I thought, this is great because it's got to be about the end. He may have another few months left. I mean, how much longer could he go? My gosh, he continued to go for another 20 years or at least, you know.
So he ran from 1972 to 2020.
2020, all right.
So he wrote 500 articles.
It's amazing.
It's an achievement beyond words.
Yeah.
And you can imagine just the timeline difference mm-hmm. of almost 50 years of writing an article. And it's all based on magic history, mm-hmm. but it could be contemporary.
But it was new stuff. I mean, in other words, he always found something of interest.
He always found something new. So it all started with his own collection. Oh, I have this really neat piece. Mm-hmm. And he starts digging in. He starts looking at the provenance and where did it come from and what. And then it just exploded because he got his friends involved. More curiosities came. As the timeline floats through, we have better tools for digital access.
Sure, sure.
I tell many different stories about how Eddie did it. And I'm always marveling at his work because it's all mostly done, a large part of it was done pre-internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is when he is going across the globe with index card in hand, with an appointment that he had written a letter 3 weeks earlier to mm-hmm. make with the special archivist. You know, it was incredible. And he would make copious notes by hand.
On these cards, index cards, yeah.
Yeah. And so so he'd written all of these articles, and Magicana has now put together a nine volume set of these articles, Scott. Mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. it's phenomenal. So Eddie was very actively working with us. I had some really difficult personal hangups that paused the project for a little bit, but I was very fortunate. He was 90 when we started this project.
And you kept thinking, I got to hurry.
Everyone kept telling me, Julie, you got to really move on that.
Yeah. Make this a priority.
So Eddie saw the first two books that were released, and we had worked very closely on 3 and 4. I was at the digital stages. In fact, I had submitted the files. Eddie emailed me and said, Julie, new information has come to light on this one article. I really want to make a one change to add this piece of information. It's vital to changing what has just been published.
Yeah.
So I had to go to the printer and yank that page and put in the
new
page.
Did.
And we did it. That was Eddie.
Okay.
And unfortunately, as much as I rushed to get the volumes 3 and 4 to him, he had fallen ill. And it was a bit of a surprise because he had recovered miraculously from a very difficult sickness. He had recovered. And earlier in the year, he had caught this cold, and we thought he would just shuffle it off, as mm-hmm. he has always shaken his colds. But unfortunately, it was just one cold too many after a very difficult mm-hmm. summer of recovery. And so unfortunately, he passed away in March of last year, mm-hmm. and I missed getting the books to him by one day.
By one day? Oh, my goodness.
By one day. Mm-hmm. I had rushed to get them to him, but he knew that they were in production. He knew that they were en route. Mm-hmm. His family very kindly told me that he had even, in his unwell state, they said it could be understood that they heard volumes 3 and 4.
He'd approved the drafts, obviously, coming out and everything before, but he just hadn't seen the final product there.
So since then, we also then released volumes 5 and 6. Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy to report to your listeners, I have just submitted files for 7 and 8.
Yeah.
So their last volume will come out very, very soon at the end of this year.
Number 9 before it'd be a good Christmas gift to get.
Yeah, it's the index, so it's a slightly different book. Mm-hmm. But there's some surprises in there on top of everything else. So
where can people order that?
Everything I've been talking about in terms of Magicana can be seen on our website, magicana.com. If you poke around, especially in the news page, you'll see, you know, the archive that we have on mm-hmm. video. We have this great exhibition, Celestial Celebration of Women in Magic. And Michael Claxton helped us curate that. That was really working from his A to Z that he did for the Linking Ring back in 2006.
Yeah.
I encouraged him to update it. He was really into it. So we did. We've reposted it. We've added to it. We've also we've created these luminary highlights. So we have a special one on Susie Wondis. We have one on Del O'Dell. Michael's the mm-hmm. biographer of Del O'Dell. And we've even added a little bit of Charlie Carrere in there too. So I'm very proud of that. You know, we keep, and this is for the public. Magicians are included when I say the public.
Yeah.
To come in and investigate, check it out, see what's out there. You know, look at Michael's point of doing an A to Z in Women in Magic is to point out how many women are performing.
Michael who? What's his
Claxton.
Claxton, sorry.
Yeah. And Michael's is the biographer of Del Odell, but he's also a great champion of looking at the diversity and the differentiation of magic that we've been able to see in history. And he's shared so much of that, you know, through his own writings. He's participated a lot in Magical. In fact, he and his friend Gary Hunt have run a series in Magical with us on escapists who are women in magic.
Oh, throughout time.
No, early. Like, we cut it off at the 19, I think the oldest we go is 1940s.
So competing in Houdini's time, basically.
Yes. And you'll learn a little bit about the upside down.
Straitjacket?
Straitjacket escape we believe it was performed by a woman first.
Before Harry did it.
Yes.
So he might have thought, that's a clever idea.
He may have.
He may or may not.
He kept.
That's Houdini, a question for John Cox, it sounds like.
Houdini kept tabs on a lot of these.
He did. He knew who was out there in his competition,
absolutely,
what they were doing or stealing from him or whatever.
Some women were right in the side of, you know, and they were really interesting acts. You know, this is a game what Gary and Gary Hunt and Michael Claxton have investigated. You know, they're championing these stories. So my point is, their stories have always been in history, but now we have champions who are looking for them and digging out their histories. And it's hard because for women, sometimes their histories just sort of vanish because they disappear from the story. You know, we can't find anymore what happened. Their names have changed. Maybe they have married. Maybe they start families. Maybe they haven't. I mean, it's really great to remember that the strength that women had to have to be not only magicians in those days, not only escape artists in those days, but a woman in those days.
A mother, you know, oftentimes, and a wife and housekeeper oftentimes, and whatever else they were doing in earlier days.
Giant limitations, incredible restrictions.
And not acceptance also. Not zero acceptance.
So I think that looking at performers of a different era and building in context is saying, the road paved for me, and how now, what can I do to help open doors for generations that are now up and coming? I think this is a really big part of, you know, what some of the work that I'm doing and that Magicana is doing. And I think it's an important part to also recognize and talk to you about, you know.
I think it is, and for everyone else to hear this and know those kinds of backgrounds and stories. Now, Magic Hall, which is, that's COL, like for collectors, short for that. Wasn't there a convention that used to be called the Magic Hall?
Yes, yes. Okay. So Magicana was approached by David Mayer in 2010, something around there. And up until that point, it was called the Magic Collectors Association, and the Magic Hall was its organ. And part of the fun of being a member of the Magic Collectors Association is there was this convention, the Magic Collectors Weekend. So it had a very long history.
So it's different from the one that was in Chicago that Jay Marshall was involved
with? That is the one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let me say that this is different from the Magic Collectors Weekend that was in L.A.
That's the Los Angeles History.
Magic
History Conference.
Which has gone away, and this kind of the expo is taking its place-ish.
And I think the expo really kind of fulfills the conference and Magical, you know, what the MCW was.
It was, right.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard, Scott. I mean, getting the programming, there are so many more magic history events that are happening now, making them special, as you can see. The programming is really challenging to find. So here, Bill Smith and his Long Beach crew who help him, he's been wise to seek out new locations, to find new programming, to find new things and activities for us to do. You know, in Chicago, when you're locked in one place, now you have to bring the magic to Chicago. So that can be a bit challenging, you know, in this day and age. I think the same was true. You know, the Magic History Conference in LA was fantastic, but they're very famous for restructuring illusions. Well, you can't bring those anywhere else.
So that's what's good by moving us around the country.
I think we were
in Austin, we were in Cleveland, and we've been
seeing
other people's collections, which I think was one of the plus sides of COVID from the standpoint that when David Sandy had put that Sunday Night Collectors together, and I know there are only about 200 or so people who I'm talking to right now who were really involved with that, whereas, you know, there are 10,000 listeners out there. But if you are a collector at all or interested in any kind of collecting, that David really had that thing together, which gave us the opportunity from week to week to see inside people's collections, because they would take their camera around and show you. Like, we wouldn't be going to have a convention in Louisiana, in Lake Charles, to be just to see Chip Romero's collection, but we could see that. I mean, I live near there and I go see it all the
Chip
time.
Chip has
but
a special collection.
That's a way of putting it. And my point is there are a lot of magicians and collectors in particular who have these collections who are proud to show them, certainly, and want people to see them.
And generous to show them.
And very generous. And so it was the result of the COVID that kind of forced us into understanding how to use Zoom properly, I guess, to let us have access to these people's collections that we would not have otherwise had a chance to see.
It was a beautiful way of bringing together a community that was really, really, we were in a scary time early on. And I think that what David Sandy and Lance Rich did, they basically, for all through the lockdown, they produced 33 mini conventions.
That's a good way of putting it. They were mini conventions. Because they started out as 2 hours. They ended up going 4 hours. You know?
Phenomenal stuff.
Yeah. Nobody
and
left.
In fact, Magicana was very pleased to see them receive the Sharing Secrets Award for, you know, the Alan Slate Awards.
Alan Slate Award, right.
Because exactly that. They brought together a community in a profound way at a really challenging time. And it shifted how we now, I think, gel as a group for magic collectors. And think about all the people who did that. You know, during that's what magic is.
Yeah.
Magic is a community builder. It allows for a happy, you know, we just saw this great panel and we looked back on 60 years of friendship with these Long Beach mystics. And I see that that's what magic does. You know, I have lifelong friends in magic.
Sure.
I really do. And I'm very grateful for all of that because it's, as the, all of the panelists were saying, you know, it's changed my life. And I know that feeling.
Well, one of the panelists, of course, was Stan Allen, who sponsors Magic Live. He had Magic Magazine for 25 plus years. And so then going into the Magic Convention, and you have on two or three occasions, along with, again, I mentioned at the top of this podcast with Jonathan Levitt as being co-hosts for many of the talks and everything.
Yes.
And I think the two of you guys just knocked it out of the park. You both do extremely well and work well together. And I like the way that, does that take a long time to try to write the script or between the two, or does Stan give you something and say, you know, here's an outline, here's what I want you to do, and then you two work together?
How it's, does that? It's a hybrid. It can be many of those things. It's a challenge because, you know, we don't get to see each other.
Sure.
You know, we're working remotely or in the past, Stan had brought in some writers that really helped, you know, form the script at first. And then sometimes Jonathan and I would then have to do our own thing. And last year was a little different yet again. So I put in a different kind of preparation. And it's a little bit of work, but I just love that kind of preparation because I get to, you know, I get to learn a little bit about each of so the presenters I'm taking care of. I get to really learn, bond, learn more about what the work that they're doing.
Yeah.
I have to introduce it. So
you spend time with them beforehand, kind of debriefing or getting a little background info?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes it's just a brief one. Sometimes, you know, I did a very long in-depth preparation for someone I interviewed recently. And I love it because I really feel like I get to learn a whole other area of magic.
Which is why I love this podcast.
Exactly. I was just going to say, I'm like a closet journalist. You know, I love investigating and learning. I love learning.
Yeah.
And Stan's convention is phenomenal at the reach that it has to a range of people. You know, we see a lot of our collector friends there, but we see a lot of our magic friends there.
Sure.
We see all these new people we don't even know who are out there.
They're just getting into it and they're going,
wow. Who now
wow.
we are friends.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
This is what magic does.
So who would be someone that stands out to you that you had talked with or interviewed during Magic Live or elsewhere when, you know, for Magic Call, perhaps as being the editor for that, that's like, this person was great. I just learned so much or he was difficult to work with, or she was, or something good, bad, or indifferent. I mean, is there somebody or bodies that kind of stick out as being?
Well, I've been really, really lucky. You know, Stan always sets me up with, and his production team always seem to match me with these amazing individuals.
Maybe that's why that it sounds so good, because it sounds like that you guys are brother and sister. I mean, you just you mesh very well as far as your questions and the way that they answer. And it's like I'm, you know, a fly on the wall.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that because, you know, here's an example. I did a couple of years ago now, I got to interview Pat Hazel. You know, I like to
sit. Yeah.
you know, Pat and I have so many mutual friends, like a ton of them, like an alarming number, but we'd never crossed paths before. So when I was, and I didn't get a lot of preparation time with Pat just for a variety of reasons. And so I met him the day before, and it turns out I was going to interview him. Like, Jonathan and I still weren't sure who was going to interview Pat, but Jonathan had known Pat and I didn't. And so Rick Gerber thought, well, this is a good opportunity, you know, maybe Julie should do this one. So I ended up interviewing. Pat and I have become really fast friends. How can you not love Pat Hazel?
Exactly.
And I was so blown away at how much we had in common and how similar our interests were, because we, you know, he just kind of, he came to magic at a different point in
sure, with juggling. I knew him when he was in high school.
And I only just met him at the Magic Live, but just to have so many similar, you know, experiences and to be really fast friends. And you don't see that every day. You know, you don't get that opportunity every day. Yeah. I also had this great opportunity last year to interview Simon Coronel, who, again, I didn't know Simon. And to get to know someone who is just so really, really fascinating, interesting, thoughtful, and creative, you know, and I see someone as invested and Ding Yang, I got to do that surprise interview with her.
Yes.
She's, I love this person. I love Julianne.
One of the best acts out there.
Yeah. You know, I am the one who gets to benefit from all of this. You know, I...
Aren't we lucky? You and I are lucky.
I love my job. I love my job.
Well, you do it so well, and that's very obvious, too. Well, Julie, thank you very much. I have enjoyed our time together over here, and I can't believe that time has slipped by so quickly.
I have much to tell you. You have to save me a spot next time. We'll save it to the next, maybe in the next expo. It's in Vegas, right?
Have to do that again. That's right, yeah. Who knows where our paths are going to cross then next. I always like to close, as you may know, of course, called the magic word of what is your philosophy of life? What's your magic word or words?
Well, I think that is to keep it all very wondrous, you know, keep looking. I love saying this, you don't know what you don't know. You really don't. And I have learned to embrace and to look at life very openly. You know, I've gone through some really interesting things in my life, and it could have set me back. And because of magic, it didn't. You know, I have a great group of friends who just turned me around and said, nope, you belong in the world.
Right.
And that spirit of not knowing what's ever going to happen, and you don't know what's going, you don't know what's, what you don't know, so you got to go find out.
Yeah.
And that for me is why magic is so wonderful. It is always evolving. So,
and I always say the answer to every question is yes. If there's going to be an opportunity, you know, don't say, well, no, I don't think I can, I'm qualified for that. Just say yes and make it happen, you know. And, but yeah, forge forward and everything. And so, yeah, you don't know what you don't know.
Keep the wonder alive.
Keep the wonder. Oh, I love that.
Yeah,
well, that's very true.
It's a Henningism, you know.
It is Henningism. Yeah. And it's an Engism. There you go.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you very much for joining us over the Magic Word Podcast. That was Julie Eng. This is Scotty out. What a delightful conversation. Thank you so very much, Julie. I appreciate your time, and it was just time well spent with some wonderful words of advice. And your story on the path that you have taken is quite inspiring to others, I'm sure. So I know the listeners certainly appreciate that. And I look forward to seeing you next convention, perhaps it'll be Magic Live out in Las Vegas. Anyhow, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. I want to remind everybody, if you would please, to like, share, and subscribe. And if you have not subscribed to the Pod Letter, please do so. If you have the financial means, then you can either donate on a one-time basis or kind of an ongoing every once in a while donate. That'll be fantastic. Even better yet, of course, would be to join the Friends of the Magic Word by being an ongoing monthly sponsor. That way that you can pledge as much as you can throughout the year. Just think about buying me a donut or a cup of coffee. That's about how much that it may cost you, or better still, maybe a nice, the cost of a nice scotch or two, or perhaps dinner, as much as whatever that you could afford. That would be appreciated. Certainly keeps this podcast going, because I would like to keep this going for as long as possible. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to find out what it is that you don't know. That way, you can keep the wonder alive. This is Scotty out.